Welcome. My name is Patrick Curran, and along with my node of one friend Greg Hancock, we make up Quantitude. We are a podcast dedicated to all things quantitative, ranging from the relevant to the completely irrelevant. In this week's episode, Greg and I are honored to visit with Yi Fong, a quantitative methodologist at UCLA, as she helps us understand classification and regression tree analysis. She describes the various ways in which these models can be used and how these can serve to inform both prediction and explanation. Along the way, we also discuss looking pensive, drunken three-way interactions, Stephen Hawking, parlor tricks, Cartman, validation, dragon boats, anxiety, spam filters, hair loss, audio visualizations, overused tree analogies, rainbows and unicorns, rain in Los Angeles, and Moneyball. We hope you enjoy this week's episode. Dude, you look pensive.
Don't even start with me. So here's what's bugging me. I just found out that there's like some giant neighborhood party this weekend, and you know me possibly better than anybody in this world. You know how I feel about that.
You are the most extroverted and gregarious person I know who hates talking to people.
I will either sit on the floor and play with someone's child. I will go off and pet the family cat somewhere by myself. During a holiday party, I memorized three recent pieces of information about sports. I made my way through the house, and then I went out and sat in my car for 45-minute chunks of time. And then I would come back and make my way through the house, and then I would go sit in my car again. I know, it's sad. It's sad.
You can speak to a room of 500 people, mm-hmm. and you look as comfortable and as relaxed and as engaged as any person possibly can. And I have been in the audience, and I have watched you finish, their applause, and someone will walk up to you at the lectern, and you will just shrivel to nothing.
I hate it. Anyway.
So what you're saying is you are horrible at interactions.
That's a good way to put it. I am horrible at interactions.
Are you horrible at other kinds of interactions?
Ooh, that was an impressive pivot. You've been working on that.
Flawless. Nobody listening saw how I moved from you being horrible at personal interactions. Oh man, magic.
This is why we make the big money at podcasting.
Aren't we $1,000 in the hole for the year? And it's January?
At least. So wait, what did you ask? Oh, yeah. Am I good at interactions in a statistical setting? You know, I don't know that any of us, honestly, is that great at interactions in a statistical setting. I think we talk a pretty good game, but we get to like a two-way interaction, and we're like, I'm out. That's about as complex as we can handle.
I can deal with a two-way interaction. If I'm really on top of my game, I can stumble my way drunkenly through a three-way, and above that, I'm just dead in the water. I don't think anybody, like maybe Stephen Hawking, could do a four-way.
A four-way interaction just means that your three-way interaction differs as a function of a fourth variable. Come on, Patrick, dumbass.
But there are two things I find interesting about interactions in the general linear model and the way that we do it. And we have a whole episode on moderation. But one thing I don't like is often how we do this. It's actually a parlor trick. If we want to know the conditional relation between x1 and y at different values of x2, we compute outside of the model the product between x1 and x2, and we bring that in as a third predictor. Mm-hmm. It's not very elegant. And that cross product that you bring in gives these conditional relations in a very strict way. We can picture it as kind of this opening fan of relations. They're symmetric and they're what are called bilinear. With the traditional ways that we do that, there's no way around that.
That's exactly right. It's like if you think of x2 as this moderating kind of variable, what you're doing is you are writing the slope that x1 has with y as a function of x2, and you put this little x2 knob on the slope and you click x2 up, and then the slope changes, and you click x2 up a notch, and the slope changes, et cetera, et cetera. And that's it, right? The slope is changing linearly. That may be nothing like what's actually going on. That's just kind of a convenient way to capture this more involved relation that our variables have with the outcome. So it's pretty primitive, all things considered.
And it's the price of the ride to get on as you bring in this cross product, and that has to be the way that those relations unfold. If you really sit down and think about it, why would we expect in real applications all of these conditional relations to unfold like this beautiful symmetric fan?
Yeah, absolutely right. Your variable, if you're thinking of it as a moderator, at a certain point just might not be doing anything anymore, right? If your moderator is family income and family income keeps going up, 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 at some point, it doesn't matter how much more money you make, that variable just might not be altering the slope that exists elsewhere. So we talk a good game with regard to moderation. We talk a good game with regard to interaction. But at the end of the day, when we model it, it is extremely simplistic and may not map at all onto the way that things are going on. Now, when I was in grad school, I had just a tiny bit of exposure to a technique that at that time was called AID, which stood for Automatic Interaction Detection. The idea behind it was that we could somehow use the relations in the data to try to better understand what the nature of these kinds of interactive relations are. But it's not called that anymore. Now it is called CART, Classification and Regression Trees.
Is that what we're talking about today?
Yeah. I texted you and said, let's do an episode on CART, man.
You did say, let's do an episode on Cartman.
No. No.
For real, I've got it right in front of me. You said, let's do an episode on Cartman.
I'm pretty sure there was a comma between cart and man.
I watched 6 hours of South Park episodes last night to prepare for this, and I'm here to talk about Cartman.
All right, that does it.
So this is a little awkward. The good news is, I expected zero intellectual contribution from you anyway. And I don't know how watching 6 hours of South Park last night is really any different from any other evening that you spend.
Screw you guys, I'm going home.
Well, as usual, when we're a little bit deficient in content, we reach out and we bring somebody in to be able to help us out. Over the last several years, I have had the pleasure of working with someone as a grad student for quite a while, and now a person who is out there in the real world. Our guest today is Yi Feng, and Yi taught about CART in one of my graduate classes for several years, and so has developed a really nice understanding of these methods. I thought it would be a great idea if we have her help us out today, especially given your anticipated non-contribution.
I think I can still contribute. I'm just going to do it in my own way.
Well, that should be fun, just fun.
Yi, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me, and thanks Jiffy for dropping me by. I just had a great tour around the Quantitude.
Quantitude Studio.
There's a tour?
There's a Quantitude Studio tour. I've seen the Island Porcelain Center, the Mona Lisa Museum, the Graveyard of Manova, and where you bury all the dead bodies. So it's great.
That's quite a tour.
Wow.
By any chance, do you validate my parking?
No.
Patrick doesn't validate anything.
Emotionally or objectively.
No, he does not.
So it's really fun to get people's origin stories. Craig Anders was in a rock band. Pascal Sheeran fell off the back of a bus.
Laura Stapleton used to row on a dragon boat rowing team.
So, E, no pressure at
no
all.
No pressure. What do you got?
It's not such a high bar for background story.
No, give us a couple of minutes of how did you stumble into this ridiculous field?
As everybody else, I was not born wanting to be a quantitative methodologist. I didn't even know what quantitative methodologist is and what they do. So for a very, very long time, I have been trying to be a developmental psychologist. It sounds fascinating. I was interested in adolescence, social-emotional development. I was interested in adolescence family relationship, especially the father's involvement. So those are the things that excited me back then. So I did a lot of work just to get me onto that track. I got into graduate programs to be trained to be a developmental psychologist. And part of my job, of course, is to go to the families and talk to those kids and then ask them questions, do surveys. And then the other part of my job is to do data cleaning, to do data management, and then fit different statistical models to the data and interpret the results in the context of adolescent development. So it didn't take too much long for me to realize I don't like human interactions.
Welcome ye.
Yes, I'm socially awkward. And, you know, it's not the most pleasant thing to talk to adolescents and especially asking them about their family relationship. So I realized I may not be the perfect fit in that direction. And also because the other part of my job, I was the modeling assistant in different labs. And then to be a good assistant, I went out to the other departments and took a lot of statistical classes, including structural equation modeling, multi-level models, and social network models. So I just took every possible statistical class I can find on campus. And that opened up the path for me, right? So that lured me to the dark side because gradually I realized I am actually more excited when I was sitting in those statistical class. Those just fascinating to me. And compared to, you know, interacting with adolescents and asking about their family relationships, I really care more about how to model the family relationship and whether this model is really aligned with the research question at hand. So that part about the methods are really, really fascinating. So at that point, I made up my mind and I applied to University of Maryland and they adopted me. They gave me a home and they are the reason I have a job at this moment. I'm now assistant professor in quantitative psychology at UCLA on the West Coast. And now I can proudly call myself a quantitative methodologist.
My favorite part about that is you tried to escape working with adolescents, and so you came and worked with me, which is really not a whole lot different. And here you are with Patrick.
The first time I met you, I don't know if you remember this, E, but I was up to see Greg. I was in his office, and Greg was like, I have this amazing student. She's working on a project. She wants to describe it to you and just see if you have any reactions. And I was like, yeah, I'd love to. You came in and we chatted and you proceeded to lay out what you apologized was a very basic question, but you just wanted to get my opinion. And after about 15 minutes, I'm kind of nodding and, oh yeah, that's how I would have done it. Oh, absolutely. Oh, that's how you solve that problem, huh? And then at the end, I said, I just think that's great. I love that. And you left and I looked at Greg and said, I didn't understand any of that. And he paused and he said, I know. And that became a psych methods paper for you.
E will never be one to toot her own horn, so let me toot away. E has already had a couple of first authored psych methods papers. While she was in graduate school, she got the Tanaka Award for outstanding paper in multivariate behavioral research. So she's doing some really wonderful things related to modeling, and she is a great person to have here to help us out with CART today.
Thank you for having me.
Purely hypothetically, talk to me as if I didn't spend 6 hours last night watching South Park episodes.
I have anxiety. That means I'm in my shell and have a hard time expressing myself. I find it difficult to engage with others. So everyone shut the f*** up because my anxiety is up here right now.
What the hell is CART and why should I care?
CART stands for Classification and Regression Trees, and it's a very popular machine learning algorithm for making predictions that can take into account of all the inherent nonlinearities and complex interactions among the predictors.
You know, there's a word that you snuck in there that I think is important. Why did you choose the word prediction?
Because CART is specifically useful for making predictions. As far as I know, I don't think people have been using CART for making explanatory modeling.
And what's the difference there? Help us to understand what we are going to be able to do, but what we aren't going to be able to do as we move forward with this.
Right. So most of our work is for causal modeling. We have some theory in our mind, and then that theory should support your model. For example, if we theorize that A is a cause of B, then we have a lot of consideration going into that. First of all, you have to define what is A and what is B. And then you have to get some valid, reliable measures of A and B. And then you have all those causal considerations going that all the assumptions you have to be met in terms of whatever causal framework you're using. And then you just estimate the causal relation between A and B, either using regression models or PASS models. And then we care about interpreting the point estimate, the standard errors, the significance test. We want to generalize the conclusion to the population based on example data. So there are a lot of considerations going into this type of explanatory modeling. We care about explaining the causal mechanisms behind the observed measures. So that's explanatory modeling. For predictions, it's another story, although it's not totally contradictory to each other. For predicting models, we care about making accurate predictions for future outcomes based on the available data. And then we want the predicted value to be as close to the actual value as possible. And that's the only criteria we care about.
So what are some research questions then that would be inherently predictive as opposed to explanatory?
One example, of course, is the COVID prediction. Another thing we are all familiar with is the spam email detection, right? So based on those key features of this incoming email, whether this email is predicted to be a spam or it's a legit email, which, by the way, most of the filters are doing a terrible job because they filled out emails from Patrick to me. They filled out the emails from colleagues from UConn to me. Like, I just don't understand those filters.
Wait. So what you're saying is the algorithm doesn't work because it filters out messages to you from Patrick?
That kind of seems like it's working really well to me.
Yes, so that's the predictive model, right? And in one of the episodes, you mentioned how Amazon or Google pushed all the personalized recommendations for you. Those are based on predictive modeling.
Greg, was it a couple years ago that I was on Gmail, you had a Gmail, and I sent you several messages that I asked you a question about, like anti-aging, hair loss, a whole bunch of things, and then for like months you would get these targeted ads.
I'm still getting the targeted ads because of what you sent me. Thank you.
You are welcome. So, E, I think those predictive models work in some cases. I was part of a group where we used this approach, and an example that we had that is relevant to you guys in education is it was a group who did online instruction for K-12 math, and they had these modules, and kids could do the modules. If they didn't pass, they had to take it again, and they had mass amount of information on millions of kids of how long they were on a module, how many times it took to pass the module, which module did they go to next, did they pass that module. And they weren't interested in mediators, they weren't interested in explanation, but they wanted to give teachers a single sheet of paper that said, for this type of kid, this is the best way to use our product. And we used a card approach to just kind of let the model go wild and say, for this type of kid, this combination of features maximizes their learning potential.
Yes, definitely. So CART is picking up its popularity in education research, although it's still limited in publications because our own field has been training people in explanatory modeling. And we emphasize a priori theory, and we didn't have too much offered in terms of the data-driven exploratory approach or in terms of the predictive modeling.
There is a researcher degree of freedom element to it. Is, wait, where is your theory? Where is your hypothesis? Mm-hmm. And this is kind of a nice way of saying, I'm not hypothesizing a mediating mechanism. I am trying to optimize some outcome as a function of my set of predictors. And the thing I want to go back to is we're not imposing these strict bilinear relations that stem from the parlor trick of bringing in a product of the variables we're interested in. Tell us a little bit about that.
CART is an algorithm that is inherently non-parametric. And as I said, it's automatically taking care of any complex interactions. So it does not have any linearity assumptions. And it also does not have a statistical model, right? So when we think about linear regression, we can write down a regression equation model. We can represent the relations in a mathematical formula. But for CART, they don't have that. Actually, it's called tree model because it looks like a tree. It has its roots, it has its branches, it has its leaves. And at each point, you are making a yes or no decision. It's yes, you go to the left. It's no, you go to the right. And then you just further go down the tree with more splits, more branches, with more leaves. So at each split, you can have different variables, right? So if I pick up income as my first splitting variable, I say if your income is below certain threshold, you go on to the left branch. If your income is above certain threshold, then you go down to the right branch. And then at the next split, we can have another variable. It can be the parent education, right? So let's say if the education level is above certain threshold, then you go down to the left. If it's below, then you go down to the right. And then after this parent education, if it's below certain threshold, it sends to the right. And then from that branch, I can do a further split, right? So I can say the amount of time students spend on the after-school tutoring program, that will be another split, right? If they are participating in this program, they go down to the left. If they are not, then they go down to the right. So what I just described is just an interaction pattern among all those variables. For people who have high income, all the other variables may not matter that much. But for those people whose family income is below certain threshold, then all the other variables come into play to make up this more complicated interaction pattern. So unlike any other parametric statistical models we have been learning, CART is just non-parametric. It just describes how you partition the sample into different regions based on those yes or no questions. And then at the end of the day, we are taking care of all those complex interactions inherent among those predictor variables.
In this example, is achievement the outcome, like kid achievement, or what would we consider the outcome here?
Yes, it can be a continuous outcome, for example, the kid's academic performance, or it can be a binary or categorical outcome, such as the kid's college enrollment or graduation on time in high school.
Okay, let's start with the continuous outcome then, which is some achievement measure. Then how do you choose that first variable, right? How did you pick income?
So just imagine if we are doing CART manually, and I'm going to put a picture in your brain, but I know nobody can see my hand waving.
It's what we do.
Welcome to the club.
Yeah.
So I'm going to put this picture in people's brain. Just imagine we have a data set, and just starting with the most simple case, we have an x-axis and we have y-axis, right? So I am going to have a scatter plot that's picturing the relation between x and y, and I'm going to color code these data points on this scatter plot based on the y value from dark purple to bright yellow, with higher value corresponding to bright yellow and the lower value corresponding to darker purple. And now instead of drawing a straight line as a regression for my prediction, I am going to slice the x-axis into two regions. And then within each part, I'm going to give one single predicted value of y. And that predicted value is simply the mean of all the data points that fall within this region. So now with me partitioning the x-axis into two parts, I have actually partitioned the predictor space into two parts. And within each space, I have a single predicted value of y. So now I want to compute the deviance or the residual between each observation versus the predicted value. And I want to do the residual sum of squares. That's the criteria for us to pick the best point for me to slice the predictor space. I want to minimize the residual sum of squares because at different places, when I put this slice, it's going to end up with a different residual sum of squares. And among all the possible cuts, the algorithm will run through all the possible options and then pick the best one that's going to give you the smallest residual sum of squares.
So it goes through income and slices everywhere. It goes through parental education and slices everywhere. And in the end, the one that has that smallest residual variance within the groups is the one that's chosen. So when you said income, that would be something like, we put a slice at $50,000 for annual income. And so we would say that if your family is above $50,000, then we predict that your SAT score will be a 610. And if your family is below $50,000 in income, we predict that your SAT score would be a 400. Is that how it works? There's a split and then you just get that one value?
Yes, if we are talking about using one split as our model, so that's actually called a stump.
Really? Stump?
Stump, yes. Just every terminology in CARD is a tree terminology.
This is tortured.
So we just go from the root node and do one split of the predictor space, and then we end up with our predicted value in each branch.
Okay. And then so you've got just two groups of people now.
Yes.
And then you do the same thing all the way down, right?
Yes.
Can the same variable come back as you work your way down?
Yes, it's possible. If you split on income as a first split, it's also possible your second split is also income. It does not necessarily have to be a different variable, because at each split, the algorithm is thinking locally. So it's just thinking, okay, right now I have two nodes, but if I want to further split each of the node, which variable and which value of that variable will give me the best results in terms of reducing the RSS or residual sum of squares if I do the splitting here. So maybe income is the best split, and it's also the best split in your subnode as well.
And that's actually what we found in this example that I did that I was describing earlier. It was actually really cool how it worked. The first split was a particular score on a pretest. So again, picture a kid. They take a pretest before they take the math module. And it said, if you're above this score, you go to the right. If you're below this score, you go to the left, as you described. But then there was a sub-split where, okay, you were above the score, but if you were above an even higher score, there was a split within that. And then it ran on down to number of modules and number of repeats and time spent on module. I thought that was a very face valid splitting of you're either above or below this first cut, but then once you're above it, then there's actually a sub-cut further down the tree.
The thing that's really cool about that is that when you cut on a variable again, you think that each of the outcomes then will be rank ordered, right? That the lowest income group will have the lowest achievement and the next income group would have the next achievement on average and the highest would have the highest. But depending on your variables, that's not necessary. And that gets back to the bilinearity that you mentioned at the beginning. You could have the mean predicted value actually drop for a group that's the highest, you know, an income group doesn't make sense necessarily. But if we think about like a low anxiety group and a middle anxiety group and a high anxiety group, your outcome might actually drop back down or pop back up in ways that are not even monotonic. And that's one of the really cool things about this model is that your hands aren't tied the way they are in what we're used to with interactive terms.
So, E, a quick question for clarification. Somebody listening might say, whoa, 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 I have been slapped and slapped and slapped to say, don't do a median split and create two categories out of a continuous variable. Exactly how is this different?
If you are talking about the cutting point for that splitting variable, the algorithm will pick a value to do the splitting, but it's not actually categorizing that variable, because then later on when you are doing the split, within that subregions, you can do the further splitting. So they are still on a continuum. They are not just stuck with this variable called lower than medium or higher than medium. They are still on the continuum in terms of that variable.
And I think that's crazy important to remember, because when I've talked to people about this, is people have a visceral reaction of saying, oh no, but that doesn't correspond to how life is lived and we can't make discrete categories. I mean, it does have almost this primordial soup feeling of mixture models and cluster analysis. Right? Is in a way, when you're talking about splits and splits and splits, it sounds an awful lot like k-means clustering, but it's really important to realize that it's a very different thing.
In essence, it's very similar to cluster analysis if we think about the idea, right? So cluster analysis was trying to form groups of homogeneous observations, and that's the same idea behind CART, right? So when we do the splitting, when we're trying to form subregions within the predictor space, essentially we're trying to form the homogeneous regions in terms of the outcome variable, because that's the way we can minimize the residual sum of squares, right? So if all the observations are similar, similar in terms of their outcome variable, then if we are making a single prediction within each region, then that prediction won't be far away from all of the observations fall within that node. So the idea is very similar, that we want to form homogeneous groups of observations. But the way CARD is doing that is different from cluster analysis. It's about slicing the predictor space in this binary splitting way, right? It's called recursive binary splitting. So we just cut the predictor space.
And something that you said there is a really important distinction. You said that it is with respect to the outcome. So when we talk about similarity or homogeneity in a cluster analysis way, we're talking about that with respect to the other observations in terms of those variables that are used in the clustering. But now with regard to homogeneity, we're talking about it with respect to an outcome, right? So that's the difference between unsupervised as cluster analysis and supervised, where there is an outcome variable or variables, which is what we're doing now in regression trees.
Yes, supervised learning is saying we have the observed outcome variable and we want to infer from that. And unsupervised learning is we don't have the observed outcome variable. We just based on the observed data pattern, we want to form homogeneous groups. So those kind of machine learning terminology can be confusing.
So I have a question, and I'm going to be channeling Patrick on this question in the following way. Patrick is a huge baseball fan. He makes no secret of that.
Says the man who memorized 3 sporting trivia things and then hid in the trunk of his car during the party.
Please, go on. It wasn't the trunk. Okay. So, you know, one of the things that we've joked about before is that sometimes you will hear these inane sports announcer kind of things like, this batter has the highest batting average on Tuesdays when facing a left-handed pitcher when there's a man on second and third. And you get these drill downs that are so specific. And in regression trees, it sounds very much like what you're doing, right? Is it a Tuesday or not? Okay, I split. Is the pitcher left-handed or not? Okay, and then I split. Is there a runner on third base? And then I split all the way down. It seems like this has the potential to just go crazy and split all the way down until each person is sitting in their own group and saying, I am unique.
You're all individuals!
Yes!
How do we keep this from happening?
Yes. So based on what we have just talked about, eventually, if I want to minimize the discrepancy between the observed and the predicted value in my tree, at the end of the day, we can have each observation end up in its own node, and the predicted value will just be the observed value itself. And then we have a perfect predicted model. The prediction error will be just zero. So it's just like the rainbows and unicorns flying over us, right? So, oh, perfect model. But that's not ideal, right? So that's actually called overfitting, because this data can contain a lot of noise, right? So the value we observe in our variables is not 100% reflecting the true data mechanism. So if we are fitting a perfect model to the data, that means we are fitting the noise part just as well. So that means if I go out and I collect another set of data, or maybe I don't even have to go out and collect an entire different set of data, I just add an observation to the current data. And then I use the predictive model to do the prediction, and may not be a good predictive model because this model contains the fitting to the noise as well. So we want to avoid that when we are doing CART. We want to avoid overfitting. So one way people have been trying to do that is to say, okay, let's put a stopping criterion out there. Say we cannot have fewer than 5 observations in each node. So we avoid building up a bushy tree with a lot of terminal nodes or leaves at the end. So that's one way to go. But usually that can still lead you to a big tree, which overfits the data. A better way to do that is actually to do the tree pruning, or sometimes called cost complexity pruning. So we start with the big bushy tree. It can be very complicated, has a lot of splits, a lot of terminal nodes, but then we walk ourselves back. We collapse some of the terminal nodes, and then we get ourselves back to a simpler tree by this tree pruning process.
You really do double down on the tree analogy, don't you? the pruning and the bushy and the stump.
I didn't come up with all those terminologies.
Well, in a point of seriousness, it actually makes it highly amenable to graphical representation of the results because you get these splits and subsplits that you can see. And indeed, I've seen a few people recently talking about using CART for evaluating complex computer simulation results. Because anybody who's done a computer simulation knows that one of the hardest things to do is present them to the reader in some meaningful way. And then as reviewers, we always demand some meta model be applied to the results. And then we criticize the meta model because you identified a five-way interaction that nobody understands. And it's kind of neat to think about, take your simulation results, what's that first split? Where does it go from there? Where does it go from there? And you have a full page graphic of that and you say, oh, dang, if it's here and here and here, this is where I end up. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah, CART, it's so intuitive. It's so easy to explain your model to someone who may not even have a lot of training in mathematics or in statistics. Right? So we don't write an equation and tell them, this is a parameter, and we want to interpret this parameter, and we want to try to tell you a story through a mathematical equation. For CART, you don't have that. You just have a tree graph, and you say, oh, this is an important variable in terms of predicting the outcome as an important split, and then down there you have another split. And then if I have these two variables, one as a first split and the other as a second split, I can tell you there is an interaction among them. So it's very intuitive and easy to explain to a lay audience who may not necessarily know all those complex statistical models.
And it's so intuitive from a theoretical standpoint in terms of trying to understand a complex world around us. One way I think about these kinds of things is, let's say I drive to work every morning, which I don't, but pretend I did, and pretend I took many different routes. I went at different times of day, drove in different weather. I recorded my time. I did that for several years. And then I ask, what route is going to be the fastest for me to get to work right now? The splits are, well, is it a weekday or a weekend? Is it before 10 a.m. or after 10 a.m.? Is it clear or is it raining? And when you get to the end, it says, take Martin Luther King Boulevard and you'll get there the fastest on average.
Yes, that's a very good example. So every day before I leave home or before I leave from the office to back home, I need to pull out my Google Map. I need to decide whether that takes more than 20 minutes of the 405 driving. If it is, I'm going to sleep in my office. I'm not going home because it's just, I can't handle that kind of commuting.
But that's a really good example, is there are 100 ways you could get from your house to the office, and it depends on what day, what time, what is the weather. Okay, anybody lives in LA, you are wonderful, wonderful people. You cannot drive in the rain.
No.
I don't know what it is about a rainy day, but just stay home.
Yes, that's the advice I got. Calling sick. You cannot drive on a rainy day.
All right. So you've been talking about, what's the term, bushy? We don't want the tree, to be too bushy here. To be honest, I was fine when we got a tree that had me in my own group, so I didn't have any other people in that group.
I find it difficult to engage with others.
Everything we've been talking about so far has been really in the context of a regression tree. But as you alluded to, if we had a categorical outcome, it would be a similar idea. We would just be predicting which category you fall into rather than what score that you have. But what I did want to ask you about, you mentioned about pruning the tree back. And one way to do that is certainly to limit the size of that. But what are some other ways that we can avoid this overfitting?
Right. So when we talk about a single tree, one potential problem is the overfitting. And the other potential problem is the instability or variance. If we fit a single tree to the data, it will probably be a good predictive model, even the current data. But then if I get a new data set, this model may not be as well. It varies a lot from sample to sample for a single tree. So the other way to do that also in terms of avoiding overfitting is to do one of the ensemble ensemble methods. Ensemble method means we have an ensemble of trees. We have a collection of trees. Instead of just relying on one single tree, we have a forest, right? So we have a bunch of them.
There it is. There's the forest.
There's a forest energy.
Wait, so is it an ensemble of forests or not? Wait, what?
Yeah, it's a collection of trees. So based on the current example, we can draw multiple bootstrap examples from it when we're doing CART. Right? So that leads us to the bootstrapping aggregation, which also called bagging. And then we can also talk about random forest. We can talk about boosting. So random forest, let's talk a little bit more about random forest because it has this nice name, which is a tree analogy. So random forest is saying instead of relying on one single tree, we want to build multiple trees. And each tree is built upon a random sample from the current training data. Right? So at each iteration, we just draw a random sample from the current data and then we feed a tree to that. In addition to this single tree, we also limit our selections of variables, right? So if you imagine if we just fit the tree to the entire data, every time if there's a very important predictor, if we don't limit the selection of variables at each split, then this tree may pick up that important variable at each time when we feed the tree. So that's something undesirable when we're doing the ensemble method. We want the trees to be as independent as possible. So one way to do that is at each split, we randomly select a subsection of the predictors, and then we only allow the split to happen within those selected predictors. And then at next split, we also do another random sample of the predictors. So in addition to the random sample of the data, we also do the random sample of the predictors, and that makes a random forest algorithm. So we have a bunch of trees, each is based on the random sample, and then at the end of the day, for each observation, we can have a set of prediction, right? So we have many predictions for one observation, and then we're just averaging across all the trees. For continuous variables, averaging for categorical variables is the majority vote among all the predicted values as our prediction.
That's pretty cool, actually. Now, you mentioned that there are multiple ensemble-type methods. Is there anything else that's popular?
Yes. Another ensemble method is boosting. So boosting is a little bit different than bagging and a random forest. Because for random forest and bagging, we aim for building up independent trees, right? So each tree is built independently of the other trees. For boosting, we are actually growing our trees sequentially. Every tree build we build at the next step is based on the tree we built on the previous step. So we'll modify our data based on the prediction results from the previous tree, and then we'll build the next tree. And then based on the current tree, we modify the data based on the results, and then we'll build the next tree. So it's a sequential tree growing process in terms of boosting. And boosting is a very powerful approach. So people can compare them side by side between, you know, bagging, random forest, and boosting. And boosting seems to be really powerful in terms of prediction. The only caveat in terms of boosting is for random forest and bagging, we are not so much concerned about whether we have too many trees, right? Because at the end, we're going to average them across the board, and having many trees is probably not a problem. But for boosting, we have to pay attention to this problem of overfitting. If we try to grow too many trees along the way, it can lead to overfitting problems if you have too many iterations going on.
I'm intrigued about something that you said earlier. These techniques do not appear to be as widely used as you might expect, given what it can achieve and often how well it corresponds to what we're trying to understand about the world. How do you think these prediction methods can live in harmony with the explanation methods, particularly in the age of pre-registration, replicability, researcher degrees of freedom?
Yes, that's a very thoughtful question. So one thing that I always tell people is if you are interested in explaining the causal mechanism, you may not only rely on the CART algorithm, although the results from the CART models may point you to something that you can do more confirmatory analysis about. Right? So if I have this set of data, and one thing we didn't talk about is the variable importance measures, how important is each variable in terms of giving prediction for the outcome. And there's a ranking, right? So some variables are super important, some variables are not that important in terms of making a good prediction, right? So although that does not confirm any causal relations or any causal explanations at all, that says about something that you may work on in the future when you have a more mature, more thoughtful theory and you want to test that theory using some of the confirmatory methods we have learned.
I like that a lot. And being super overly defensive about my baseball desire. Is any baseball fans out there, when Greg disparagingly talked about facing left-handed pitchers with a runner at second and third or whatever that was, did you notice he's talking about Billy Bean and Moneyball? And if you don't know what that is, go read the book Moneyball. It is literally taking a data analytic, data-based process to maximize run production in the game of baseball. And it reinvented baseball about 20 years ago.
What's this?
This is the code that I've written for our year-to-year projections. This is building in all the intelligence that we have to project players.
Okay.
It's about getting things down to one number. Using stats the way we read them, we'll find value in players that nobody else can see.
There's an amazing movie. It's called Moneyball. It stars Brad Pitt as Billy Bean. Mm-hmm. And when the movie is made about my life, I kind of want Brad Pitt to do that because obviously it's like looking in a mirror for me.
Uh-huh.
You want to be in the same terminal node with Brad Pitt?
I would like to be with a platypus, Greg, and Brad Pitt would be our terminal node. But I really like that notion of a mechanism of hypothesis generation. We found this optimal split. Well, why would we expect that to happen? And could we then replicate that in a more a priori way to try to understand what is the mechanism that led to that? I feel like this is a drastically underused set of procedures as we try to navigate an increasingly complicated world.
And maybe it's because people aren't getting enough exposure to this. I don't know if it has worked its way into social science curricula, because it has its origins well outside of the social sciences. So, E, do you have any recommendations for where folks might go to learn more about this?
Yes, surely. I was fortunate enough to be the TA for two machine learning workshops. One is taught by Dr. Doug Steinle for CenterStat. I was also the TA for the machine learning workshop at the University of Maryland, the Center of Integrated Latent Variable Research, Silver Center, as taught by Dr. Tracy Sweet. And those are very, very informative short courses to get people to know all those techniques and how to do those techniques. And there are also some online resources. When I was teaching myself about all this CART stuff, I went to the website of a very nice book. It's the Introduction to Statistical Learning. And two of the authors are people from Stanford, Trevor Hasty and Robert Tupushrani. They also have very nice YouTube videos. They are like the Stanford version of QuantiDudes, I would say.
So it's Quantitude, but they know what they're talking about?
They're like, you know, old married couples and finish each other's sentences.
Hey.
Like, it's just very much like you guys. But they are just talking about those machine learning topics, including CART. And those are very, very useful resources.
Okay, so E, I do have one more question for you. Because you and I have spent a number of years together, you have been lurking in the background of the podcast, right? And in fact, I will let listeners know, a couple of years ago, E gave to me this beautiful framed Lego of Jiffy's face that she designed and created, and it's been hanging in my office. So what's it like for you now being on this side of the podcast?
Yes, I did have the honor to be working with Greg for many, many years. And throughout these years, part of the mentoring experience is I was lurking outside of his door and listening to him recording the Quantitude episodes.
No, you weren't.
And I heard everything that you cut off in the final release version. So I know all the jokes. I know all the dirty tricks behind the scene. But now I am part of it.
Wait a minute. Did you hear stuff that Patrick said?
I do.
Everything?
I do. You don't see me. I was a latent variable outside of your door.
Oh, my. I am not going to sleep tonight. Just remember, right now we're at minute 78 of our recording, and this will be cut down, you know, to whatever sub hour. And we have all of your outtakes. And so if you want to go mutual assured destruction, you just remember that I have this audio as well.
You will respect my authority.
Whoa, wait a second. You are going to use that against me at some point? Uh-huh.
You said that, not me.
Screw guys, I'm going home.
There we go. I knew this episode was about Cartman. Thank you, E. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, that does it. Screw you guys, I'm going home.
Thanks so much for joining us. Don't forget to tell your friends to subscribe to us.
Because subscribing makes you feel good.
Thanks, Cartman. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever they go when they're feeling all alone in their terminal node. You can follow us on X Twitter, where we are at QuantitudePod, and visit our website, quantitudepod.org, where you can leave us a message, find organized playlists and show notes and syllabi, listen to past episodes, and other fun stuff. And finally, you can get cool Quantitude merch, like shirts, mugs, stickers, and spiral notebooks, from redbubble.com, where all proceeds from non-bootleg authorized merch go to donorschoose.org to help support low-income schools. You've been listening to Quantitude, the podcast suffering from so much overfitting, it should probably be pruned all the way back down to the stump. Today's episode has been sponsored by...
Oh, excuse me, Greg. Is it okay if I bring our guests through here?
Oh yeah, sure, of course.
Come this way, E. That was a really good show. You did great.
Do you really think so?
I mean, have you heard Dan McNeese?
Oh, yeah.
Hey, did you want to stop by the Quantitude gift shop?
Sure. Ooh, is this a whack-a-mole game?
Yep, we love whack-a-mole.
And is that a...
Poking stick, yep.
Cool. What are those?
Oh, those are Quantitude catheters from the...
New Year's episode, I remember.
Do you want one?
I'm good, thanks. And what's this? A book?
Yep.
The Quantitude Guide to Getting Other People to Find You Tolerable. I thought they don't do self-help books. Or self-help of any kind.
Yeah, it's not a great seller.
Hey, what's this?
Ooh, that's a replica of Patrick's thinking log. It's where he goes to get all his ideas. It could help you get good ideas.
Has the real one ever helped Patrick to come up with good ideas?
That's a good point.
You know, I think I would just take a signed Jiffy picture for my office at UCLA.
Really?
Of course. I've been a huge fan. You have no idea.
Aww.
Want to see my Jiffy tattoo? Look.
I'd rather not.
Look.
No, thank you.
Look at my tattoo.
Oh, boy. This is most definitely not NPR.
Look, damn it.